All right, so we're here with Scott Guthrie. Scott, tell people who you are, what you do, like they if they don't know.
Cool. Yeah. My name is Scott Guthrie. I'm vice president in the developer division at Microsoft, and I run the teams that build a lot of the core of .NET, so things like the CLR and the base class libraries. And then I run the teams that build our web stack with ASP.NET and IIS and Commerce Server and our Media Server products and our visual web tools that support it. And then their client stack with Silverlight and WPF and our Visual Studio tools that target that as well.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
So Silverlight 3
yep.
is here. And last time we talked to you was before Mix. And we sort of had sort of the marketing kind of conversation, which is important.
Mm-hmm.
And we touched on some of the things that are currently known about Silverlight 3, at least at mm-hmm. that point. And so today I thought we'd really kind of dig into what is Silverlight 3, what's new, mm-hmm. what does it represent? So, you know, let's talk.
Yeah, well, we shipped our first release of Silverlight in the fall of 2007. And then we shipped Silverlight 2 in October of last year, I think October 20-something.
Okay.
And so, you know, we're now, gosh, I don't know, four and a half months from that ship point here at Mix. And we're now releasing today the beta of Silverlight 3, mm-hmm. Which is our next major release. And we kind of outlined the roadmap of where we're going with Silverlight 3 in my keynote
mm-hmm.
and talked a little bit about kind of what it has and what it provides.
Excellent.
And you know, Silverlight 3 for us is a major update. Lots of improvements across the media stack, the graphics stack, and kind of the overall application development side of things. Major improvements with our expression set of tools. And so in particular, the new Blend 3 has a bunch of kind of really, really groundbreaking developments in terms of support for prototyping, better integration with VS, so TFS support, C# and VB event handler support,
nice.
Photoshop and Adobe tool import support. So you can now take comps built with Photoshop and import them there. Lots of great stuff in Expression. And then we're also today releasing a preview of our smooth streaming server for IIS,
right.
which lets you build Olympic quality like video, both pre-recorded video, so videos like the show we're doing right here,
uh-huh.
As well as live video. And so we can actually stream live events now going forward and be able to do that with our kind of adaptive streaming capability so that mm-hmm. you can go up to 3 or 4 megabits per second in terms of quality mm-hmm. and really have super HD level quality over the web.
Now, adaptive streaming was in Silverlight 2,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yeah, we kind of pioneered it with the Olympics project last summer with Silverlight 2. And basically the way adaptive streaming works is we take a video and you can take HD video and you can basically encode it at multiple bit rates. Mm-hmm. And so you might have a version, say at the Olympics, we had about 1.5 megabits per second as kind of a standard high-end HD source. And then we basically had versions at 1.1 megabits and 800 kilobits. Basically, we can then monitor kind of the network traffic and the client capabilities of the machine and adaptively switch between those different resolutions depending on what kind of network connectivity we had.
Mm.
And the switching between them is very smooth, so you can't even notice it. It also means you get instant seek as you kind of seek into a video. It's sort of instant on, like experience. And so we did that with the Olympics with pre-recorded video. So in other words, once an event was over, we encoded it and then put it live on the website. For live video, we still basically broadcasted fixed streams, so at like 650 kilobits for live events. And so what we're doing now with the Smooth HD support is basically shipping a server for free that you can download and install on any IIS box that gives you the ability to, take videos that you can use the expression encoder, which is about $199. You can take this video of this event, you can encode it at multiple bit rates, copy it onto your smooth streaming server, and now you can deliver, HD quality video
nice.
Super easily. And then also with our smooth streaming, we're adding the live support so that we could be, have an HD camera feeding directly into an encoder and actually broadcast this live as it's happening. And we basically provide TiVo-like experiences where you can pause the video, live video, you can rewind live video, you can replay and catch up on live video.
That's amazing.
So yeah, so all in HD. So lots of great media support that's coming out. Other things we announced with Silverlight 3 in the media side are H.264 support, as well as AAC video audio support.
Okay.
And so basically you can take the same files that work on an iPod or work on an iPhone, you can now actually play through Silverlight. And so just basically greatly enhances, you know, the variety of video that you can play.
Excellent. Now, with Silverlight 2,
yep.
I remember we had this same conversation, and we sort of focused on like the notion of the advent of the cross-platform CLR.
Mm-hmm.
With the delivery mechanism being with Silverlight. How has the CLR sort of from 2 to 3 evolved? I mean, do you have learnings, things like that? I mean, I'm kind of a bit twiddler kind of geek, so I kind of want to know, like, at that level, what kind of changes have been. Have there been any?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely have been some changes between the Silverlight 2 CLR and the Silverlight 3 CLR. Less so in the core engine, per se.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, obviously, we always make tweaks in terms of performance and code gen and things like that. More so in the core libraries. So there's much broader library support inside Silverlight 3.
Excellent.
So, you know, ranging from, you know, much richer data support, you know, some of which fall into the kind of the UI bucket of, you know, we now support element-to-element data binding. So you could have a drop-down list in a data grid, and the data grid can be bound to the drop-down list value.
Okay.
Or you could do master details. We support, basically an in-tier data transfer thing we call the .NET RIA services. And so if you want to build a line of business application or a data intensive or data entry application, mm-hmm. We now support the ability where you can publish what we call a domain service on the server that exposes data and also supports updates of data.
Hmm.
And then we'll actually manage a client proxy for you automatically inside your Silverlight project. And so you can request the data, you can make changes to the data, and then the cool thing is you can call submit changes and push those changes back.
Nice.
And so we'll actually do all the diffing algorithms to only send back the appropriate data. And so, you know, that just eliminates a ton of, code that you otherwise would need to write today in order to manage that.
Mm-hmm.
And makes building data-driven apps pretty darn easy.
Absolutely.
The other big, I'd say, infrastructural change on the CLR side that we've mm-hmm. made is to support the ability so that you can what we call cache a framework library. So at Silverlight 2, typically there was the libraries that were built into the core Silverlight 2 package. With Silverlight 3, we obviously still have lots of libraries built into the core package, all the ones that were in Silverlight 2 plus a few more. But we also now have the ability where we can ship what we call a framework library is a separate download.
Mm.
The first app that needs it goes ahead and downloads it, and then that gets cached for future apps.
Excellent.
And so that way we can kind of effectively hydrate your machine over time with more framework libraries. And if your app happens to use one of those libraries, it doesn't have to take the download hit. Excellent. And so that sort of enables you to have much smaller apps, which, you know, ultimately translates into faster download and startup time.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember that was like a question that we talked about a long time ago. We went a tour on the .NET team with Jason Zander,
mm-hmm.
and we had some of the architects came and met us in the lobby or whatnot, and we talked about, you know, one of the things that would be interesting would be modularized
mm-hmm.
.NET.
Mm-hmm.
And so on demand, give me what I need from a library perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, you know, you're moving that way.
Yep.
And what I would ask is, given all the interdependencies between various libraries, how was that experience of pulling things apart? And like, for example, there will be some libraries I can't do that with, right, or not?
Well, actually, we support pretty much any of the core framework libraries. We support that model.
Okay.
And now, obviously, if you have a dependency on assembly A, which is a dependency on assembly B, you need to make sure you reference both within your app.
Sure.
And then we'll do the transitive closure.
Nice.
So we'll support, you know, we pretty much every assembly we could support that with. All the assemblies that were in Silverlight 2 are just built in.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we have more types and more built-in framework libraries. But this gives us a nice release valve where we can add more and more features and more controls over time and not grow the core package. Silverlight 3 has a huge increase in terms of capabilities. I mentioned some of the media stuff, the mm-hmm. new codecs, the data stuff. We have hardware acceleration for graphics. We have, you know, much richer graphics support with things like shaders and bitmap and pixel APIs. We have perspective 3D and 3D transform effects. We have support for running Silverlight both inside the browser and outside the browser. And so you can actually take apps offline, and we have offline support. A whole bunch of other things we can talk about in a little bit. But you know, what's cool is with all that additional support, you know, we've also focused a lot on how do we keep our code really tight, how do we keep it really fast, how do we keep it really small. And so believe it or not, the actual Silverlight 3 download size is actually about 30K smaller than the Silverlight 2 size, even with all those new features.
Awesome.
And that's not upgrade. That's a clean machine installing Silverlight 3 from scratch.
That's excellent.
We also got a little bit better compression, which helped. But but it's meant that the overall package size is still super small, super fast, less than 7 or 8 seconds to install on a clean machine.
Outstanding. You mentioned one thing that really kind of perked my ears, because I remember an interview I did with you with Dr. Sneath, Tim Sneath. Mm-hmm. I call him Dr. Sneath because it's just fun.
Mm-hmm.
We had this conversation. I had brought up, basically I had said something along the line, what about running, you know, Silverlight outside the context of the browser?
Mm-hmm.
And then Tim pointed me to a blog post where the person there was like, Charles is such an idiot, asking all these stupid questions. And so I was like, well, maybe that wasn't such a stupid question. I mean, let's talk a little bit about that scenario. I mean, running Silverlight outside of the browser clearly means you don't have to have the full framework installed, which you would to run WPF, right? So let's talk just quickly about that scenario and where you think it would be useful. You mentioned offline.
Yeah. Well, so Silverlight outside the browser has no system dependencies. So to work on, you know, a machine with XP that does not have .NET, does not have the .NET framework installed. So you can just have Silverlight 3, the 4 meg download, 6 seconds later, you got it installed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, but at the same time, typically the scenarios we're going after tend to be different than the full .NET framework.
Sure.
So it's you know, for the most part, looking for applications where they're web delivered.
Mm-hmm.
Often they're integrated into a website or part of an overall website experience. And often where you want to deliver is in a sandboxed way.
Okay.
You know, I think one of the things that you know, a lot of people like about the web is the fact that they can trust the apps. They can type in a URL and not feel like it's going to hose their machine. And what we're trying to do is provide the same experience with Silverlight, both inside the browser but also outside the browser. And so you can right-click on a Silverlight control, or a Silverlight app can integrate an install button into their experience. And when you click that, the user gets prompted, where do you want to save a shortcut to this? Mm-hmm. So it's not you're installing this big scary thing. It's basically, where do you want to put this?
Mm-hmm.
They click OK. And with that, we'll basically download an offline version, or a version that can run outside the browser and offline, mm-hmm. store it locally, pop open a separate window frame mm-hmm. that's just hosting that particular control or whatever they want to host it inside it. And it's still running sandboxed. So the user gets to choose what the app can and can't do. But say, for example, with Win7, you can go down, you can right-click, and you can pin the app to the super bar. Mm. You can store it in the start menu. You can store it on the desktop. It will work also both on Windows and the Mac. And within the app, we also then give you support so that you can detect, are you online or offline?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can also, if you pull out the network cable, the app continues to work, and mm-hmm. the app can know that it's offline and take appropriate action.
That's awesome.
So if you wanted to channel 9, if you want to build a player where you could click, I want to download these 12 sessions,
yep.
in the background it could be downloading those sessions for you, mm-hmm. pull out the network cable, go on a train or go traveling, mm-hmm. go on a plane, you can watch those videos offline.
Excellent.
You know, a bunch of interesting scenarios start to get enabled that way.
Mm-hmm.
Still, you know, very much again focused on web scenarios and kind of web content and delivery based scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to build Visual Studio with that. You're not mm-hmm. going to build, you know, giant, you know, Windows apps with that. Mm-hmm. That's where the full, you know, WPF and the .NET framework really makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And having that continuum where the same programming model that works in Silverlight works in that full .NET framework, we think gives us kind of a special end-to-end story there.
Absolutely.
But for, you know, again, for a whole bunch of web scenarios, and both consumer as well as content, you know, we think that this out-of-the-browser story is a nice option that you can do some interesting stuff with.
Absolutely. I like it. I think I'm going to play around with it.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, it's nice is also from a developer perspective, you can build your app once,
mm-hmm.
the work to make it go outside the browser, basically you just go into the manifest file and you set support out of the browser equals true, recompile. You can optionally add as a resource some icons to mm-hmm. your Zap. Once you do that, though, then you have the basics of everything you need, and the end user can right-click on your app and say, you know, install this application locally. Obviously you can go further, but one of the things that I think we've done a good job of is not try to invent yet a new programming model. It's just a ends up being a fairly seamless way to go ahead and integrate it inside your app.
Excellent. So, you know, there's this sort of canonical expression or, you know, euphemism or whatever the correct terminology is, where people will say in the software industry, you don't get software right until version 3. I'm sure you've heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it's necessarily the case of Silverlight, but it's been out for a little while now, and I'm just curious, I mean, how are people actually really using it in the real world? What kind of feedback are you getting, and what have you done based on that feedback to mm-hmm. build Silverlight 3 to be something that more people want?
Sure. Like, we're seeing really good feedback. I mean, I think... you know, especially with Silverlight 2. I mean, Silverlight 2 is really, in many ways, kind of our V1 in some mm-hmm. ways. You know, it's the first version that had the .NET support, and the first version that had really differentiated media capabilities. And you know, we're seeing some great feedback in terms of people that have gone live. You know, mm-hmm. if you look at, obviously, the Olympics last summer was huge for us. Things like the Democratic National Convention, mm-hmm. and then more recently, President Obama's inauguration.
Yeah.
You know, the actual presidential inauguration committee went live on Silverlight. So the official inauguration
awesome.
Was there, as was CBS's coverage of it. And it, you know, if you read any review on the inauguration, the top two sites that people picked were providing the best quality experience tended to be those two.
Awesome.
By a fair, wide margin. You know, going on right now is March Madness, mm-hmm. And CBS is broadcasting in HD. The NCAA basketball game, all done with Silverlight. They've also, throughout the both the football and basketball seasons, have been doing their college sports, all done with Silverlight. You know, Netflix is using Silverlight for streaming their high-quality media experience. In the UK, Sky Television, which is the big cable and satellite provider, are now broadcasting both live as well as on demand for their movies and subscriptions and TV shows, all done with Silverlight. Home Shopping Network is live. You know, lots of line of business applications are going live. And then today in the keynote, we showed a couple of pretty cool apps that are providing kind of advanced kind of reading capabilities, so that you can actually browse content often from magazines from years past, and so we demoed Rolling Stone, and then Playboy is actually going live with Silverlight, and so just read the articles, not the pictures, but Charles, but yeah, you can actually browse past subscriptions there, mm-hmm. And there's a full interactive reading, deep Zoom experience.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a whole bunch of things I can't say.
That's awesome. I've heard just about every joke on that front, but it's...
But I mean, for like a Playboy's, you know, come on, it's not that over the top. But nevertheless, like an astronomy magazine, right?
Mm-hmm.
It'd be cool to deep Zoom into astronomical pictures, mm-hmm. And be able to really take it, just not the picture that was in there, but rather go grab a bunch of data from some server cluster that mm-hmm. has, and then stitch them all together and photosynth them and dive into them. I mean, the future is really, really bright
yeah.
in that area.
And that's, you know, that's kind of the experience that we showed today, of, you know, having, you know, it's hardware accelerated, it's using deep Zoom, it's super smooth in terms of a navigation experience, of really taking content and providing something that you don't typically see on the web today,
mm-hmm.
and really build that kind of immersive experience. And you know, the other nice thing that we're doing with Silverlight 3 is doing a whole bunch of work around SEO and bookmarking and navigation support.
Hmm.
And you know, in the past with RIA-based solutions, whether they're Ajax or Flash or Silverlight, you know, typically, you know, the back forward button often don't work or don't work the way you want them to, and you can't bookmark, you know, a content that you like. And you can't necessarily find it in a search engine. You know, by having the rich immersive experience, having the smooth graphics, and then also having the SEO support and the bookmarking and the navigation support, you kind of get the best of both worlds. And you know, I think there's a whole bunch of interesting content scenarios out there where being able to build kind of this much smoother experience really unlocks a lot of potential.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, there's a sort of an asynchronous project that's going on along with your development team's progress, and that's the Mono people and their implementation of Silverlight compatibility for Linux.
Yep.
How's that relationship going? I mean, it's
good.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they shipped Silverlight 1, or sorry, Moonlight 1.0 about a month ago, over a month ago. And basically, that provides a Silverlight 1.0 compatible engine that can play, you know, all the same video formats that, that Silverlight supports, use the same XAML markup, and so on, and be able to play, you know, and basically experience apps. My team kind of delivers to that project the actual Linux versions of the codecs. And so we're actually dropping the VC1, the AAC, and the future H.264 codecs to them that they can use.
Awesome.
And then my team also delivers all of our test cases. And so they have an automate, you know, they have a way they can basically run all of the same tests we use internally against their implementation for, from a compat perspective. So it's been great to see. And, you know, earlier this year for the presidential inauguration, you know, a lot of people asked for the presidential site, you know, especially the official inauguration committee site, hey, I want to be able to run it on SUSE or on Red Hat or, you know, a Linux distro. And, you know, they were able to download it and install Moonlight, and I think there were 50 or 75,000 downloads of it, and be able to watch the inauguration smoothly. So that was a cool. You know, I think a lot of people have often said, "Well, you know, is this Linux thing real? Are you really serious about it? You know, who's using it?" And so it was pretty cool to be able to see the real event live. You know, live video is hard to do, right? You know, being able to do it inside a you know, browser on a Linux system and have people think the experience was great.
Sure.
You know, it was a good test.
That's awesome.
Yeah, for an event as big as that one was.
Cool. And I mean, here we have, you know, you guys are actually working with this sort of small community of Linux developers, or, you know, open source sort of developers. I think that's a really excellent sort of story that I don't think enough people kind of think about. Like Microsoft is not trying to blow these people up, but rather trying to help them.
Yeah,
I think that's a remarkable fact that I think sometimes just gets forgotten.
Yeah, it's been going great.
Cool.
Yeah.
So keep it up, Miguel and company. It's very cool stuff. So we've talked about, one of the things I think is interesting is the notion of programmability. And this is sort of jumping into, you know, I'm a developer, I want to write a really rich user interface, and I'm going to use this sort of WPF kind of, you know, meta language in Silverlight. How's that working? Okay, I mean, what I mean by that is, are developers really digging this sort of XAML kind of experience?
You know, what we typically see is, you know, developers that have kind of learned both WPF and Silverlight tend to be fairly passionate about the technology, which is always a good sign in terms of, hey, there's something special about the technology. And so, you know, we feel pretty good in terms of people finding, you know, some of the things that WPF kind of pioneered. You know, there's all, you know, you can have buttons and you can have text boxes and things like that. I think some of the things that WPF really pioneered, though, is this concept of control templates.
Okay.
And this concept of things like triggers or we call it Visual State Manager, where you can kind of, you know, have control templates and you can have skins, for lack of a better word, and basically be able to apply them to controls, but also integrate interactivity and responsiveness. So that instead of having a button that just looks like a button, you can actually, you know, sculpt what does it look like when you press the button? You know, what's the animation look like going up and down? You know, is it responsive? Is it jiggly? You know, how does that work? And, you know, in a traditional UI framework, you can often skin things, but you can't really control both the look as well as the feel. And that's really where I think Silverlight and WPF have kind of pioneered some interesting spaces and brought it in a more applicable, broader way to a lot of developers without having them, you know, without requiring them to do owner draw or something that's beyond most people. You know, I think one of the things that we're then doing, you know, that we need to continue doing is, how do you provide tooling support so that you can take advantage of all that power and do it in a really productive way. Mm. And you know, I think our that's one of the reasons why we created the Expression Studio of products, was basically to say, look, there's a with all this power comes the need for us to both provide a way for you to take advantage of that power really productively, mm-hmm. but also be able to bring in designers or interactive experts mm-hmm. who aren't necessarily developers, who don't necessarily even want to think about XAML. Mm-hmm. They want to think about the experience, they want to think about the interaction, the relationships of things.
Absolutely.
And they want to have a tool set that feels natural to them. And you know, one of the things I think is really exciting that we showed today was the Blend 3, which is kind of the evolution of our Blend products. Mm. And really, I think with Blend 3, you joked about the third version of the product always being right. Mm-hmm. I think Blend 3 really is a killer release. Excellent. In terms of hitting a whole bunch of fundamentals in a pretty substantial way. Mm. One of the big ones is with this new feature we're calling Sketchflow, which basically provides a way that someone using the tool can prototype very quickly experiences and get feedback on them, and then be able to transfer those into real applications. You think about, take Channel 9 or take any project you've ever worked on.
Okay.
Where oftentimes you start out with a whiteboard or you start out with a notepad and pen, mm-hmm. and you say, here's roughly what the app's going to look like. We're going to have a button over here, we're going to have the search thing here, we're going to have the video there. Mm-hmm. And then you go and you show it to someone and they give you feedback and you're sketching on this paper. That works for very simple things, but as you start building more complex apps, or as you start building things that tend to be multi-state, or things that actually have multiple screens that interact, you start to start pasting up these things on your whiteboard, and then when you want to take it to a customer, or you want to take it to your boss, or you want to take it to a client, it's often very hard to kind of clearly articulate that.
Sure.
And get across the meaning. And people use Photoshop with comps, people use Visio with wireframes, there's lots of different techniques. Mm. What Blend now has built-in support for is the ability for you to basically say, okay, I'm going to create these navigation pages. Here's the relationship in terms of order between these pages. I'm going to build each page as a XAML screen, and I can basically add any controls I want to it. Hmm. They then have a cool look, which is kind of a sketching look. And it's basically just a set of custom skins, but you can basically drop a button in with a what we call a wiggly skin on it, hmm. or a list box with a wiggly skin, and it looks hand-authored. And so it has rough lines, and it literally looks like someone with a pencil wrote it.
Okay.
What's nice about that is you can build the UI and have it look still in the kind of rough, this is to get feedback kind of look, as opposed to finished button. And so when you show it to someone, their eye doesn't actually gravitate towards, ooh, I don't like this color. It instead gravitates towards, is the experience right? Is the feature set right? Is the navigation right? Mm. Is the interactivity model right? And then we basically have a player experience so that you can give it to a client and they can actually, either with a pen or with a computer, mm-hmm. they can highlight what they don't like, they can add annotations, and then we can actually take all that feedback and inject it back on the design surface inside the tool.
Awesome.
And so you can show it to three or four guys, get the feedback, and then literally kind of like comment annotations inside PowerPoint or Word. Mm-hmm. You can actually see, oh, people didn't like this, didn't like this model or didn't like this interaction or thought this was mistitled. And you can basically rapidly iterate.
Awesome.
And then what's nice is once you're finally done, one is you have XAML files that you can then just start coding against, mm-hmm. and then two, you can actually take these kind of wiggly skins, and you can actually add the real Silverlight skins or a custom skin to it, and really start polishing up the UI. And so it ends up being kind of a really rapid way to do prototyping, and I think will end up being kind of transformational. Mm. In terms of the experience you have with clients and customers.
Awesome. And it does sound like really the first real edition of Expression that targets professional designers. Well, in the sense that when you're interacting with customers and you're able to easily show them what your design thinking is.
Yeah,
that's what I mean by that.
Yeah, well, I think we like to think the previous person targeted professional
no
designers
as
well.
To the Expression team.
But I think this is the first release where the previous releases were very much focused on how do you build a tool that enables you to help build Silverlight or WPF apps. And the way you participate in that is very much of a, I'm helping a developer. I think this is the first release where, you know, you as designer don't have to touch code, you don't have to see code, you don't have to write code. Mm-hmm. You don't have to work with a developer in order to get your app to the point where you can actually get feedback on the interaction, you can get the basics up and running. Mm-hmm. We have a cool concept called behaviors, which basically allow you to say, like, you know, when something gets dragged and dropped from here to here, do this. Mm-hmm. Or when this button gets clicked, navigate here. So a designer can wire up those behaviors without having to write C# or VB.
Excellent.
And we also support this concept of, we've always had this concept of data binding, but we also now support design time data as well as kind of declarative data. Mm. And so you can actually say, I'm going to define a data called customer. It's going to have, you know, this four fields, and I'm going to put sample data in those fields. So we have, you know, so, and you can define all this without code or without XML. You can literally just inside a dialogue say, here are the four fields. You know, we have the lorem ipsum factum that you can fill in, but we also have sample address data or sample telephone data or sample email or sample website data. And so you can actually just say, oh, you know, the customer address thing is an address. Pick UK addresses or US addresses and we'll come up with 1,000 addresses for you. And so, you know, it's really easy for you without, again, having to write code, without having to fill in an XML file, to define sample data that you can then apply into the app. And that way you can see what it looks like, and you can use the Sketchflow feature so that you can actually see it, both the designer as well as runtime. And, awesome. You know, that whole experience, you know, plus the behaviors, plus some of the graphic stuff we're doing around 3D and things like that, I think really for a designer, you know, makes the tool feel much more comfortable in the sense of I'm using a pure design tool where I'm doing something where I don't need to participate with a developer. I can do it myself.
Excellent.
And then obviously I can collaborate with a developer, but it's not a I'm beholden to get something from them before I can make progress.
You know, and this actually brings up a really good point that we often never talk about, and that is, you know, fundamentally Microsoft has not really been a designer product company, right? We've been a platform company. Mm-hmm. We produce infrastructure and libraries to support developers creating their vision.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're moving into more of this design phase because, of course, we get it, the importance of user experience and whatnot. What has that been like for you coming from sort of the engineering side to be like, okay, we're going to build a designer-focused product? What was that like? I'm just curious as to what that experience was like because it's sort of different than let's build Visual Studio, right?
Sure. Yeah, I mean that's to a large extent why we created a separate product line with a separate brand, a separate identity, was we said, you know, we don't want this to be, you know, a design tool based on what developers think designers want. We want a design tool that is really what we think designers want.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we hired the team, you know, from a very, you know, designer background, you know, a lot of experts on the team who have worked, you know, at a variety of different companies before Microsoft, focused on building designer tools. And so really understand that customer base well and some of the needs well. You know, I think there's an interesting opportunity for the industry over the next couple of years, which is how do you build interactive design in general? You know, Bill Buxton uses this analogy. If you think about, industrial design, you know, that came about not in the 1800s, not in the 1900s, but in, you know, the late 1920s, you know, literally as the Great Depression was starting, was really the first industrial design jobs were created. And the whole idea of an aesthetic or, you know, how you build kind of great industrial design into you know, manufacturing products really came about around that time frame. You know, if you look at, you know, Ford automobiles, you know, the Model T and the Model, you know, all these famous cars, you know, it used to be, you know, you could have any color but black and they had a very fixed look.
Sure.
And, you know, and General Motors came along and came out with a new car that, you know, was very polished and really incorporated industrial design and just, you know, changed the industry almost overnight to the point where, you know, Ford actually shut down their production line for I think 6 or 9 months to retool to come up with a new car to compete. You know, that all happened in the last 100 years. I think we're right at the point where with the web, and it's, you know, it's been happening over the last couple of years where we now have a platform with the browser, you know, both in terms of HTML and CSS, but also in terms of things like Silverlight, things like Flash and other plugins, where you can now build an aesthetic and build in user experience and have kind of a canvas and a set of paint, so to speak, mm-hmm. at your disposal that you can create kind of these interactive, engaging experiences that you couldn't build before. Mm. And we have a distribution mechanism with the web where, hey, if you build something cool, everyone can go use it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think we're going to be in the same place where industrial design was, 90 years ago or 80 years ago, with interactive design, over the next couple of years, where it's groundbreaking, it's new. We don't entirely understand what's needed. Anyone who claims they really understand what interactive designers need, mm-hmm. The reality is it's changing every year, every month. Mm-hmm. And I feel good that, with things like Blend 3 and Silverlight 3, and I think our roadmap going forward, I think we're going to participate in that process pretty well.
Excellent.
And, really start to push what can be done. Mm-hmm. And I think things like Sketchflow in particular, some of the live data support, some of the behavior stuff, mm-hmm. Really starts to pioneer some things that haven't been done before with other tools.
Excellent. And you're sort of pushing .NET into that space.
Yeah. And we're also, one of the other things that's nice about Blend that gets big applause every time we demo it is we're also adding support so that you can use our tools with other existing designer tools that already exist. And so, one of the big things that people love about Blend 3 is Photoshop import support. And so, Photoshop is one of those tools that is fairly ubiquitous.
Sure.
In most designer shops and web shops. We now have the ability, you can take any Photoshop PSD file. We parse apart the different layers in the file, so you can choose to import all layers or just a subset of the layers inside that file. And we can actually import, text, we can import vector, we can import graphics, and we'll actually have we'll give you the option at each layer level where you can say take the text, convert it into text elements in Silverlight or WPF, and we'll even take the font information and the actual word and glyph information.
Great.
And import that as well. And so, for designers, or a web shop that says, hey, my designers all use Macs, great. Have them use Photoshop, have them use Illustrator. Mm-hmm. They can create the same types of comps as well as art that they do today. Mm-hmm. Now it's super easy to import that inside Blend, convert it to XAML, be able to do the interactive parts, be able to use the Sketchflow parts, behaviors, live data. And then when they're finally done, they have a XAML and set of controls that a developer can add further support to.
That's amazing.
And that workflow is starting to get, I think, really pretty smooth.
Oh, that's really, really cool. Yeah. So one of the things that we have to talk about, because every time I do an interview these days with engineers at Microsoft building very interesting products, is, concurrency and parallelism. Mm-hmm. And so obviously the CLR is, there's work that needs to be done there for it to scale to a million cores, for mm-hmm. example. I mean, obviously it's pretty scalable as it is today. But, rich user interfaces, this whole thing we talk about, interactive design, that's really where parallelism plays a huge role, because you want to have a lot of asynchronous workflows. You want to have a lot of parallel computations happening mm-hmm. on the data somewhere else. That doesn't affect my experience. And so what sort of things are being done in the Silverlight kind of machine to think about, wow, what would Silverlight look like running on 1,000 cores, mm-hmm. right, inside of a browser or outside of the browser? I mean, have you thought about at that level? And how would I use a parallel library in Silverlight? I mean, it should be just questions like that. I'm curious.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I think with parallelism with client apps, there's a couple of different dimensions of parallelism that you need to think about. One is just painting pixels to the screen, and one of the things that we've done with both WPF and Silverlight that I think is a fairly profound change in the way from a program model perspective that enables better scaling is kind of the move to what we call a retained mode graphic system. And so, if you think about, the contrast would be a case where, you're painting, you have a code that imperatively paints pixels to the screen versus a world where you say, oh, I want to load a button or I want to paint something and the system will handle repainting and validations and clipping for me, mm-hmm. as opposed to me actually having to write a message loop doing that.
Sure.
And one benefit of that is it takes a little bit of the necessary code out of your logic and places it in a slightly higher level, you know, language for expressing that. And you know, with Silverlight today, we actually support rendering on to, up to 8 cores, I think, with Silverlight 3, where you know, if you have an 8-core system, we can actually partition up a canvas across the 8 cores. And because we have the retain mode instructions, we can actually parallelize the sequencing of the painting across
Excellent.
Those different cores. Now, there's an interesting question, which is long term, to what extent do you use you know, cores and software to do the rendering versus where do you push it onto the GPU?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a variety of different graphic kind of approaches. And so, you know, my sense is probably it'd be more GPU based in the future.
Mm.
And with Silverlight 3, we're adding GPU support for acceleration both with DirectX on Windows and we use OpenGL on the Mac. And so we are going down that path of how do you do the GPU instructions. But there's a lot more, you know, there's continued to be more work on that front in terms of us doing it. But having this kind of the move to go from, you know, imperative, let me tell you what to do,
mm-hmm.
to or how to do it, mm-hmm. to instead going to a mode where you sort of say, this is what I'd like to do,
mm-hmm.
With things like XAML and a retain mode graphic system. I think that's the most important thing for us to get parallelism right.
Absolutely.
In the UI space. You know, then there's code execution, which is okay. Now I want to process algorithms in parallel or things mm-hmm. like that. You know, there, you know, Silverlight has, since Silverlight 2, been multi-threaded.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can absolutely, you know, create threads and do work on different threads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, I'd say, you know, the thing that really is required to do multi-core well, though, is anytime you require a developer to create locks or do their own thread synchronization,
yeah.
9 times out of 10 you'll get it wrong.
Sure.
Or worse, you'll get it right on some systems and you'll get it terribly wrong in others, depending on the CPU characteristics of the machine. And so again, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is, from the .NET perspective, is try to get the developer out of the how to do it and instead thinking about the what to do.
Exactly.
And so things like Link and some of the parallel Link libraries that we've been putting out,
mm-hmm.
you know, are really about, you know, express your intent as opposed to the operations you want to do. And we can then take, for example, like a link query, mm-hmm. which isn't saying iterate over a for loop over this collection looking for this thing. Instead, you're saying take this sequence, use this query algorithm, return me back a set. You know, we could, for example, with a, you know, in a parallel link world, take that, partition up the data across 8 cores, have them do it in parallel, and then reassemble in sequence. And so, you know, that I think long term is going to be the key to getting across many, many cores.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I'd say we're on a path right now where we feel pretty good in terms of providing parallel code execution across, you know, several cores or dozens of cores. You know, getting to thousands or millions of cores. The reality is, you know, I don't think anyone can scientifically claim that they know exactly. You know, at some point you do start running into just sort of memory bus contention and things like that.
Of course.
That you know, we're thinking about right now, but I wouldn't necessarily claim we've solved.
Absolutely.
But those are the types of things that we are definitely looking at.
Perfect. And finally, I was just reading on the internet, a researcher has created an embedded DSL for C#. It's called Bling,
mm-hmm.
for making it easier for developers to write pixel shaders
mm-hmm.
based on WPF library.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering about your thinking around the notion of creating sort of embedded DSLs so people don't have to rely on WPF sort of in the kind of clumsy way. No offense. When I say clumsy, I only mean sort of the XAML-based kind of,
mm-hmm.
and there's no events in XAML.
Is this you're saying for pixel shaders
yeah.
specifically?
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the things that we did with .NET 3.5 SP1 with WPF, mm-hmm. and then we're adding with Silverlight 3 is we are actually supporting pixel shaders in both Silverlight and WPF, and you can basically create pixel shaders and apply them to any shape or UI element or control.
Okay.
And we support the same model in both.
Okay.
There's a shader language called HLSL.
Exactly. Which, C-type, C-level.
Yeah, it's kind of C-like
yeah.
in the sense of, but it's sort of C scripting. It's sort of an interesting kind of mix. But it's designed so that, you know, it can be safe in terms of operations. It's obviously important in the web. And then you can compile it down into kind of multiple formats. And so with WPF, we actually can compile it down and run it directly on the GPU and do GPU-based shaders. And then with Silverlight, for security reasons, you know, we can have our built-in shaders can go on the GPU. For the first release, we're being a little careful. And so we sandbox our shaders a little bit. But basically, you know, we support effectively this DSL for creating shaders that you can use as well. And so that now is supported as well in Silverlight. So,
amazing.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, hey, is there any little hints of what's coming for Silverlight 4, or we want to stay out of that territory? Like, what are some of the things you're thinking about? How's that? You're not going to deliver, but what's on your mind now? Silverlight 3 beta is out the door. Obviously, you have to make the RTM.
Yeah.
But I know that in reality, when you're working on, you know, version X, you're working on version X plus one, mm-hmm. sometimes asynchronously, at least some people mm-hmm. are. So what sort of thinking are you?
We definitely we have people already working on Silverlight 4.
Sure.
Part of the way we're able to do these kind of fairly rapid release cycles where we can get major releases, you know, within 12 months of each other,
which is great.
Is obviously through parallel development. So, you know, there's a bunch of pretty cool features that we're looking to provide. not quite ready to share all of those yet.
Understood.
But definitely know that there's some very cool things coming along.
Perfect.
And you know, and it won't be out, you know, too far from now. So,
perfect.
You know, generally, kind of, I feel pretty good that from a release mechanic perspective, we're now in a point where, you know, we're doing fairly rapid releases, you know, at a yearly or sub-yearly cadence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we add more and more of these features in, it's cool to start to see the apps that you literally can't build anywhere else start to be not only doable, mm-hmm. but, you know, to the point where, you know, effectively with commodity tools and commodity server software, anyone can start to build these.
Awesome.
And, you know, that's where I think the web's going to get really exciting in the years ahead is, you know, as we start to, you know, you're no longer limited by the tool set or the platform at your disposal. You're really starting to, you know, you're limited only by your creativity. That's going to be a pretty exciting place for us to be, both as consumers and then as developers and designers taking advantage of it.
Absolutely. Awesome, Scott. So. Well, hey, great job.
Cool.
As usual. And thanks for coming on Channel 9.
No, my pleasure.
We know you're busy and you can sit through a long Charles interview. It's very impressive.
No, cool. No,
thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Great job.
Yeah, thanks.
Peace.